Today we're going to hear the fifth and final program in our series on the Radio Cafe, Thinking Like a Watershed, a series of panel discussions that focus on responses to the water crisis in the West. Each of these panels is intended to provide a variety of cultural perspectives concerning global warming and climate change. They're produced and moderated by author and oral historian Jack Leffler.
Hello, and thank you, our loyal audience, for coming. I subscribe to the New Scientist magazine, which is a wonderful magazine. And in a recent issue, there was a book review of Fritjof Capra's new book, which addresses systems thinking with regard to looking at biology. In other words, how everything is interrelated. And that's precisely what we've tried to do with this series of panels. We've tried to present the different components of the whole picture. And it's that whole picture that we have to look at, in my opinion, before we start making these King Solomon decisions about how we're going to legislate the use of water. And so with that, I'm going to introduce our wonderful array of panelists this evening. Here's John Fleck, who writes for the Albuquerque Journal, science editor for the Albuquerque Journal, and Sonia Dickey, who is a wonderful writer who's written extensively about the Central Arizona Project, about Glen Canyon, and Mike Hammond, who is our area director for the Bureau of Reclamation. Our panel. We'll begin with John Fleck. John, go right ahead.
Thank you much. Thanks for all coming out this evening. I love that map, and it has always fascinated me, but there's something about it that I didn't notice until last time, the last one of these sessions that Jack had, that John Wesley Powell, when he made that map, made the same mistake that we in the United States have been making for more than a century, which is he stops the map at the U.S.-Mexico border. And the watershed of the Colorado River doesn't stop at the U.S.-Mexico border. You see that little white line slipping down toward the Gulf of California and Sea of Cortez? That's what used to be the Colorado River Delta. It used to be a magnificent ecosystem, a million acres of cottonwoods and willows and salt marshes and wetlands. And as we dammed the Colorado River over the course of the 20th century, first with Hoover Dam in the 1930s and then with Glen Canyon Dam, we slowly but surely starved that ecosystem of water so that you have 100 miles of what used to be the most magnificent estuary and river delta ecosystems in North America completely dried of water. And there's a place along the river, the Colorado River, which I first visited on a reporting trip four years ago, just outside of Yuma, called Morelos Dam. And it's the last dam on the Colorado River. And I was meeting with Jennifer McCloskey, who runs the Bureau of Reclamation office down there. And she said, well, you really ought to drive the levee. So she showed me how to get out to the levee from her office over this series of little dirt roads. I started driving down the levee. And you follow the Colorado River, kind of makes a sweeping bend out of Yuma. And you get to Morelos Dam, and the Colorado River stops. And that's such a dramatic thing to see. In March of this year, March 23rd, I was back at Morelos Dam, sitting on the downstream side over on the Mexican side with a little group of diehard environmentalists and water managers and government officials from Mexico and the United States, a little group of about 100, 150. We're on the downstream side, down in the Colorado River Channel, downstream from Morelos Dam, and we watched them open Gate 11 and start letting water through Morelos Dam. And it was the first time, it's believed to be the first time anywhere in the world that an environmental flow across an international border was done purely for purposes of benefiting the environment. And it was a spectacular thing to see. For weeks, following the water down, you know, the communities having water returned to their river, the wildlife. It was just a spectacular thing to see. And it was a little experiment, but I think it's important to understand how and why it happened, because I think it says a lot about where we are going and where the opportunities are to succeed in solving the problems that we've been talking about in these last four sessions. Lake Mead is on the verge of, sometime next month, it will drop to the lowest level that it's been in history. Well, since they filled it. I mean, it used to not be a lake at all. But since they filled it in the 1930s, there's extreme tension in the lower Colorado River Basin among various water users, especially between Arizona and California. Las Vegas is extremely vulnerable because as Lake Mead drops, their water supply is at risk. And yet, in the face of all of that, 100,000 acre feet was run down the river as an environmental, political, and public policy experiment. And that's an enormously hopeful thing, and it's worth talking about how it happened and why it happened, because it's a model for the way we're going to solve problems going forward, or the way we may fail if we don't succeed at doing this. There's an enormous history of tension between the United States and Mexico. For a long time, the United States asserted the position that we didn't have any obligation to give them any water. And yet, over the course of the last 13, 14 years, an agreement was negotiated that allowed an environmental flow to go back into the Delta to meet the environmental needs down in Mexico. So how did this happen? And this is an example of how deals, agreements, collaboration can finally work. So how did it happen? There was a giant earthquake, a big earthquake in Mexicali in 2010. The earthquake damaged Mexican irrigation system. The Mexicans couldn't take their full delivery of irrigation water. Mexico and the United States negotiated a very quick agreement that temporarily Mexican water that wasn't going to be used in their irrigation system because it was broken could be stored in Lake Mead. Las Vegas loves this. It keeps Lake Mead up, keeps the water above their intakes. So Las Vegas benefits. Mexico benefits because they have the ability to store some extra water. At the same time, Los Angeles is short of water. They're looking for new sources of water. And folks from the Metropolitan Water District just start to talk to folks in Mexico. How could we help you help pay for efficiency improvements in your irrigation system? Maybe we could get some of the water. You'd get more water for your irrigation system. So you've got that going on. You've got environmentalists who are trying to figure out how to put more water in the Delta itself, and the stars aligned, and people crafted this deal where the cities benefit in America. We're rich. We're rich enough to help pay for irrigation system improvements in Mexico. The Mexican farmers get a more efficient system. The Mexican farmers, there's a strong desire on the part of the farmers in Mexico to see some water return to the river that flows through their midst. So suddenly you have rich urban users in the United States acting as advocates for the environment and the farmers in Mexico, because it's the kind of thing where everybody benefits. Fighting over this resource isn't going to work anymore. Instead, we have to figure out how to collaborate if we're still going to have the cities we want to live in and the farms we want to grow our food, and in the course of this, some water that we can leave in the rivers themselves for an environmental flow. It was a little experiment. This could fail. We need more water in future years. We need money. Environmental groups are helping to raise money to pay for additional farm improvements to free up water for these environmental flows. But it's a baby step, and it's how we learn how to do this sharing. You know, started talking to Jack about doing these panels. At first, I didn't like the title, the word crisis in this title. But I went to my dictionary as I was thinking about talking, and you know, a couple of definitions: a time of intense difficulty, trouble, or danger. Probably yes, maybe not danger. I don't know, you know, but certainly intense difficulty and trouble. But a time when difficult or important decisions must be made. And yes, absolutely. So I'm cool with crisis now.
That was Craig Newbill's idea.
I'm cool, Craig, wherever you are. I'm cool with crisis now. But the other thing is thinking like a watershed, and I think it's really important to understand how we need to frame thinking like a watershed now, and what this little experiment of an environmental flow in the Colorado River Delta can tell us about that now. Because what we have done is kind of blown up John Wesley Powell's idea. I mean, first of all, we did it by drawing these arbitrary lines for governance that are not along borders, but we've also taken water from the Colorado River watershed. And for better or for worse, and I know Jack and others argue that it was a terrible idea, but it's a thing that's done now. We've moved water to Denver, and we've moved water to Albuquerque, and Santa Fe and Albuquerque, and the Middle Rio Grande Valley, out of that basin and into this basin. We've moved water to Los Angeles. We've moved water to the farms of the Imperial Valley, and we've done an amazing amount of water moving in and around California, so that suddenly all these communities are tied together in this common community of water-using interests. So we've created this uber watershed, this giant watershed that stretches all the way from Albuquerque to Sacramento and Los Angeles and Denver. And the only way we solve problems now is if we think like that whole watershed, and we realize that the folks in Denver and the folks in Albuquerque and the folks down in San Luis Rio, Colorado, in Sonora, that we all share this common interest, and we get beyond the fighting over water, which is a longstanding tradition, and figure out how to collaboratively share. And I think the experiment in the Delta that I just seen is a really hopeful example that is in fact possible.
Thank you, John. Wow, that was a really positive thing we just heard. Mutual cooperation instead of mutual antagonism, which Peter Kropotkin thought was the only way to proceed, who was my hero, by the way. No, that was really great. And our second speaker, who knows a heap about water, actually, Mike Hammond and I were on the Rio Chama together about 6 months ago, más o menos. And what was really funny is that it hadn't rained and it hadn't rained, and we got on the river and it let go big time for hours, and it was terrific. But at any rate, our second speaker is Mike Hammond, who's the area director for the Bureau of Reclamation here in this region, and he knows more about the ins and outs of water than I do, that's for sure. But Mike, please, thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you. Well, I think I'm the only federal agency representative that has been on your group of panels, so I relish the opportunity to give you folks a bit of the federal perspective, at least from Bureau of Reclamation's point of view, within New Mexico. And I'd like to follow what John was saying in terms of what's going on in the Colorado River. There was a compact negotiated between the seven states in 1922, and we also have a similar situation that is the treaties for what we do in the Rio Grande, and that's the Rio Grande Compact that was negotiated in 1938. So that's where the similarities end. I think if you look at the Colorado River Compact, it basically has a huge reclamation presence with the Colorado River Storage Project, all the dams and the power production and all the things that went with that particular reclamation effort. And it also has the Secretary of Interior as the river master, so to speak, there guiding hand of some kind, working with all the states and all the other interests. So in the Rio Grande system, it really defers to the states. Each state administers their component of their activities to meet the requirements of the compact. They have a certain amount of flow that passes a gauge, and then they need to of that a certain percentage needs to be delivered to the downstream state in accordance with the way that compact was organized. And we also, one of the reasons the compact was put into place is the Rio Grande was over-appropriated by the turn of the 20th century. All the states have dealt with things differently. Colorado is required to deliver at the border for New Mexico, and then New Mexico has an index gauge, and they deliver down to Elephant Butte for Texas. How reclamation functions in this area is we fill in the gaps to support the Rio Grande Compact. And in Colorado's instance, we built the Closed Basin Water Salvage Project, which allowed for, over time, to pump that water that was normally lost to evapotranspiration in the closed basin, to pump it out and deliver it to the border to help Colorado meet its long-term debt. Well, lo and behold, around 1985, there was a spill at Elephant Butte, and their debt was wiped out. So now the Closed Basin Project is utilized to help them continue to manage their water resources up there and to meet their compact obligations. Now, New Mexico took on a different strategy, and it's kind of multifaceted. They are adjudicating a lot of the tributaries in and around northern New Mexico. Rio Chama is close to being completed for their adjudication. Some of the most senior Acequia water rights, late 1600s, early 1700s, are in the Rio Chama area. And those have been adjudicated. And then they're also focusing on Indian water rights settlements with the in the Taos area and also in the Powaki Basin. But they have not tackled the big process of adjudicating the main stem. The strategy there is to work, the reclamation works very closely with the state of New Mexico, with our river maintenance program, and also managing the Middle Rio Grande project in order to maximize the delivery of sediment and water through the system. In 1970, we closed the gates at Heron Lake and began diverting water from this, as you mentioned, from the Colorado River basin for the purposes of meeting several needs, M&I for Albuquerque and Santa Fe and other smaller communities up and down the Rio Grande. Most of the cities are now developing it. It's taken this long, some 40 years, for the cities to really figure out. They've been able to survive on their, dewatering the aquifers, and now it's time for them. They realize that they need to use surface water as their checking account, so to speak, and convert and allow for the groundwater to become their savings account for a drought period. So both Albuquerque and Santa Fe have shifted their approach to diverting surface water directly from the Rio Grande, and the San Juan Chama water allows them that opportunity to do so. So it also serves as another resource for the Bureau of Reclamation to lease to meet the Endangered Species Act requirements for the silvery minnow and the southwestern willow flycatcher. So the San Juan Chama project has played a really vital role in that we've actually sent in the 12-year period that we've been working on this roughly 750,000 acre feet down the river. To support the endangered species activities and to create a good living habitat there. But yet we have been unable to actually remove the silvery minnow off the jeopardy status that it currently has. And it's primarily hydrologic driven, but we also have a degraded baseline situation with the channelization of the river, the levee system, and also the lack of administrative flexibility in the system that our federal projects currently have. That's one of the processes that has unfolded over time, is that each of Reclamation's projects have been authorized in a point in time for a specific set of circumstances, with not, as you said earlier, not with a really long-term foresight in terms of how things could change in terms of long-term water shortages, possible, you know, Endangered Species Act issues that we couldn't foresee. So they're single a lot of our projects are single-purpose authority-driven. There's incidental benefits that go with those, but what we would like to do, and what I think it's going to take a strong effort to do, is to follow the example that John pointed out that's going on in the Colorado system, is for us to get together and fully analyze what are the total possibilities within the entire watershed. San Juan Chama is probably the least vulnerable if you look basin-wide, but even there we see a 15% shortage over the next 40 or 50 years. Mm-hmm. Wow. that the climate models are saying might occur. So we need, you know, it's incumbent upon Reclamation to try to inform folks of this possibilities, take a look at all the options that are available to us. If it takes reauthorization of projects, if it takes different systems that could better capitalize on the new hydrologic regime, and also with an eye towards improving the ecological systems that these dams and traditional water operations has degraded over time. So that I feel very optimistic based on my tenure as the area manager over the last 4 years, that folks are getting that more holistic view and wanting to expand our flexibilities and our understanding of the system so that we can meet these very huge challenges that we see coming before us. But like I said, it's a trying time, but I'm also very optimistic that if we can keep out of federal court and focus our attentions on the things at hand, I think we might be able to make some progress.
Beautiful, Mike. Wow, we've had two optimists tonight.
And then there's me.
What a whopper. Okay. And our third panelist is an old friend, Sonia Dickey, whom I've known for quite a number of years now, who has, her dissertation for her PhD really got into a whole bunch of stuff that's been fascinating to me for a long time. It revolved around Glen Canyon Dam and the effect of that kind of stuff on the indigenous peoples of the area. And she wrote a beautiful chapter for our book where she focused on the Central Arizona Project, which to me is a strange model unto its own. But at any rate, Sonia Dickey.
Thank you, Jack. I'm basically going to give you a stripped-down version of that, a very stripped-down version of that chapter this evening. In the mid-1960s, when Peabody Coal initially obtained mining leases from both the Navajo and Hopi tribal councils to extract coal, many Navajos still lived in isolated family groups and hogans scattered along the backside of Black Mesa, where they herded sheep, goats, and horses. Likewise, traditional Hopis inhabited the escarpment's southern promontories, raising corn, beans, and squash just as their ancestors had done for generations. Once a Pleistocene lake, Black Mesa now resembles a human hand tracing the contours of this ancient body of water. For thousands of years, vibrant forest and aquatic plant life embraced the ancient lake before decaying into a bog that over time hardened to 21 billion tons of high-grade, low-sulfur coal, the female mountain's lungs, according to Dene mythology, and one of the largest and richest coal deposits in the United States. Seams 3 to 18 inches thick reach the surface, allowing Peabody to employ both surface and strip mining techniques in its quest for the raw material. Peabody's relentless raising of Black Mesa in search of coal severely eroded the region's soil, reducing its fertility, polluted or in some cases depleted the area's rivers and streams, including sacred springs fed by the Navajo aquifer that support Hopi land's first, second, and third mesas, destroyed native plants and animals, and resulted in the forced removal of hundreds of Navajos from their traditional homeland, the largest Indian removal since the U.S. government officially abandoned the practice at the end of the 19th century. Enormous drag lines and bulldozers raped and pillaged the land, terrorizing its native inhabitants whose families had lived there for generations. Strip mining on Black Mesa is intricately tied to the multi-layered, interconnected history of indigenous water rights, water reclamation, and the privatization of natural resources in the American Southwest. Plans for various infrastructure projects began in the region in earnest at the turn of the 20th century and culminated during the Cold War with the passage of the Colorado River Storage Project Act of 1956, promoting Glen Canyon Dam as its sensational star, and Congress's approval of the long-awaited Central Arizona Project as part of the Colorado River Basin Project Act of 1968. Federal laws and interstate projects historically ignored indigenous claims to the region's rivers and streams, and these two laws differed in no significant way from their predecessors, especially considering the tremendous growth the Southwest witnessed during the post-World War II era. The Cold War essentially propelled federal expenditures in the region as the Department of Defense consumed the area's open space to support its military bases, naval shipyards, Air Force landing strips, and nuclear test sites. defense spending had ignited a firestorm of development rapidly spreading to southwestern urban centers. Phoenix proved the most remarkable. By the mid-1950s, Arizona ranked as the fastest growing state in the Union, and Phoenix stood poised for a long, explosive boom. City planners set all the machinery in place in order to attract new settlers, civic boosters, primarily financed by military spending and the aeronautics industry, spearheaded capital improvements and development projects, including roads, airports, housing initiatives, water supplies, sewer systems, and parks. Yet business leaders and congressmen surmised that although Phoenix still lacked capital, the city's water needs had reached critical mass. Arizona is at a crisis point, Senator Carl Hayden testified at the CAP hearings in 1963. The state urgently needs more water to meet her rapidly expanding domestic requirements, end quote. Indeed, the Grand Canyon State demanded water and electricity to illuminate its developing cities. Conveniently, Phoenix rested on the edge of the Colorado Plateau, a rich storehouse of natural resources and home to the nation's largest native communities, both crucial for a colonialist system dependent on Indian assets to feed the dominant culture. From 1963 to 1968, Arizona's political players, including Secretary of the Interior Stuart Udall, Senators Hayden and Barry M. Goldwater, and Representatives John J. Rhodes and Morris or Mo Udall, Stewart's younger brother and successor in the House, revived the state's long-standing fight for a federally funded Central Arizona project to pump water from the Colorado River uphill to the state's Central Valley. Their plans included dams on both ends of the Grand Canyon. The idea of flooding the Grand Canyon ignited a firestorm of controversy among environmental groups, spearheaded by Sierra Club Executive Director David Brower, and no doubt, Stuart Udall's post as Interior Secretary bolstered the Grand Canyon State position within President Johnston's administration. Arizona's native communities played an important part, too. Both environmentalists and CAP enthusiasts wooed the Hualapai and Navajo nations in an attempt to obtain indigenous support for their respective agendas. Ultimately, they wanted to influence public opinion on debates surrounding the Central Arizona Project, as both sides used Native people to play on the nation's sensitivities towards civil rights. Although Stuart Udall and his posse promised the Hualapais tremendous economic benefits from Bridge Canyon Dam, they never offered the Navajo Nation compensation for a structure at Marble Canyon. Goldwater told geographer Stephen C. Jett, a young professor at the University of California, Davis, at the time, that as far as he knew, the Navajos possessed no legal rights to Marble Canyon and had not been consulted. The senator admitted that the Department of the Interior refused to acknowledge Diné claims to the site. The failure of CAP devotees to include the country's largest Indian nation as beneficiaries arguably hindered the advancement of their dam agenda. To make matters worse, CAP lobbyists had agreed to pay the Hualapai $16 million for the construction of Bridge Canyon Dam on their land near Peach Springs, Arizona, while denying Navajo claims to the Marble Canyon site. Their actions infuriated Navajo tribal chairman Raymond Nakai and other Diné leaders, convincing them to reconsider their support for hydroelectric dams in Grand Canyon. The Navajo Council backed proposals calling for a dam at Marble Canyon as late as 1961, when Arizona still planned on constructing a state-funded Central Arizona project. On May 3, 1967, however, Nakai wrote New Mexico Senator Clinton P. Anderson, chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on Water and Power Resources, outlining the Tribal Council's new stance. In his letter, Chairman Nakai expressed frustration with both the Arizona Power Authority and the Federal Power Commission, state and federal entities charged at different times with constructing and maintaining a dam at Marble Canyon, and the agency's refusal to offer the Navajos, quote, reasonable compensation, quote, for the use of their land. The chairman then dropped a bombshell. 9 months earlier, on August 3, 1966, the Navajo Tribal Council, asserting Diné rights as a sovereign nation, had passed Resolution CAU 9766, insisting the proposed dam would flood 46 miles of scenic reservation land. Our resolution makes quite clear, Tribal Councilwoman Annie Dodge-Wanika contended, that the great expenditures contemplated for the two dams are wholly unnecessary. Instead, the Navajo Tribal Council wanted to exploit, quote, the huge deposits of coal buried in the Four Corners and on Black Mesa. We have learned, Wanika told the press, that hydropower cannot possibly compete with cheaper thermoelectric plants stoked with reservation coal, and we have concluded agreements with Peabody Coal Company and Utah Construction Company for burning Navajo coal to power what are probably the largest, and this is my insertion, and dirtiest plants in the country. On February 1, 1964, Peabody Coal Company's predecessor in interest, Century Royalty Company, signed a 10-year lease with the Navajo Tribal Council to extract Black Mesa's coal. According to lease number 8580, Century Royalty agreed to pay the Navajo Nation a variable rate ranging from 25 cents to 37.5 cents per ton of coal sold and utilized off the reservation in exchange for the right to mine approximately 25,000 acres of Navajo land on Black Mesa near Kayenta, Arizona. When coal from the Kayenta mine remained on the reservation, the Diné pocketed between 20 and 30 cents per ton, depending on the total amount sold. In addition, Century Royalty rented the Kayenta mine from the Navajos for $1 per acre per year for the agreement's first 5 years. In other words, the Navajo tribe initially received $125,000 for the use of their land, excluding any royalties from the sale of coal. Finally, Century Royalty agreed to hire Navajo Indians when available for all positions, with one caveat: the company or lessee judged the qualifications of potential workers. At relatively the same time as the Navajo Tribal Council entered negotiations with Century Royalty, Secretary Udall realized that legislation for a Central Arizona project must contain alternative sources of power. The Navajos' rejection of Marble Canyon Dam, combined with fierce public outcry over inundating parts of the Grand Canyon, persuaded the Secretary to consider other possibilities for fueling the cap. Although Udall asked his interior underlings to explore alternative options for energy production, he knew about the mining lease between Century Royalty and the Navajo Nation prior to the Navajo Tribal Council's announcement of its plans for the tribe's coal deposits. The Indian Mineral Leasing Act of 1938 required the Secretary's approval of all agreements between Native peoples and commercial enterprises, since the federal government holds Indian lands in trust, and in an effort to ensure Indian communities, quote, received maximum profits, end quote, and a lease's terms represented, quote, their best interest. In May 1965, Commissioner of Indian Affairs Filio Nash sent Secretary Udall a memo informing him that Peabody had proposed to install two coal-fired steam generating units of 1,000 megawatts each and had requested to use approximately 2,000 acres of Navajo land close to Lake Powell for the new plant. In addition, Peabody anticipated burning up to 6 million tons of Black Mesa coal per year and needing 40,000 acre-feet of water annually to operate the generating station. The latter would no doubt come from Arizona's, read the Navajos, heretofore unused yearly apportionment of 50,000 acre-feet of Colorado River water allotted to the Grand Canyon State by the Upper Colorado River Basin Compact of 1948. In addition, based on the royalty rate summarized in its agreement with Century Royalty, the Navajo Tribal Council would potentially receive at least $1.2 million each year from Black Mesa's coal fields. The Navajo Tribal Council signed a second 10-year mining lease with Century Royalty Company on June 6, 1966. This time, the agreement covered mining operations on 40,000 acres of the Navajo-Hopi joint use area, 2.5 million acres of land, quote, shared between the two tribes, and the focal point of a hotly contested land dispute that erupted when Peabody Coal Company first discovered coal within JUA boundaries in 1909. The two leases totaled approximately 100 square miles, loaded with 337 million tons of coal. The raw material supplied the Mojave Generating Station at Bullhead City, Nevada, for nearly 30 years, and it continues to feed the Navajo Generating Station at Page to this day. The Department of the Interior, working closely with Peabody Coal, seemingly orchestrated the industrialization of the Navajo Reservation in order to proceed with reclamation stratagems for Arizona's Central Valley. On August 17, 1966, just 2 weeks after the Tribal Council condemned the proposed Grand Canyon dams and announced their plans for Black Mesa, James H. Krieger of Best, Best & Krieger, a California-based law firm representing Peabody's interest in the West, informed the Department of the Interior that Peabody's, quote, investor group would place the Arizona power plant, quote, next on the list, end quote, if the agency could guarantee Peabody early assurance of the water. As a bonus, Peabody estimated that construction would require approximately 300 workers. The following February, 6 months after Peabody's proposition, Udall rescinded his support for hydroelectric dams in Grand Canyon and lobbied instead for a coal-fired power plant on the Navajo Reservation abutting Lake Powell to fuel the CAP. At the time, Udall adulated the benefits of mineral extraction for the Navajo Nation, but confessed years later that the whole Central Arizona project would have failed without an energy source. Since nuclear power was not sufficiently advanced at the time, Udall maintained, some of the Arizona people and some of the power companies got busy and put together this Page power plant. Given Peabody's close working relationship with Western Energy Supply and Transmission Associates, a united consortium of 23 investor-owned and state, municipal, and federal electrical utilities, some of the power companies Udall referenced no doubt helped devise this new plan. Navajo leaders also realized the potential monetary benefits of extracting raw materials. In September 1966, the Arizona Republic, a Phoenix newspaper, announced an agreement authorizing the use of Black Mesa coal for the production of electricity at a coal-fired steam generating plant near Las Vegas in Clark County, Nevada. The facility, dubbed the Mojave Steam Station, would supposedly yield more than $30 million in royalties for both the Navajo and Hopi nations. Not surprising then, council members supported Udall's recommendation for a thermal generating plant near Page in lieu of hydroelectric dams to provide pumping power for the Central Arizona project. The new plant promised the Navajos jobs and additional income, longtime priorities of the Navajo Tribal Council, and guaranteed the Southwest urban centers a seemingly endless supply of electrical energy. Historian Alvin M. Josephi, Jr., who actively protested strip mining on Black Mesa during the 1970s, accused the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation of facilitating the uninhibited growth of southwestern cities. During congressional hearings for the Colorado River Storage Project, approved in 1956, for example, Reclamation had lauded Glen Canyon Dams for its production of hydroelectric power, while purportedly negotiating with private utility companies for coal-fired power plants. Quote, the Bureau had the usual self-serving reasons for busying itself with these added projects. There's Josephi penned in a damning piece on the murder of the Southwest published by Audubon in the summer of 1971. As everyone knows, he wrote, without projects, there's no need for the agency. Indeed, Reclamation divvied up, transported, and delivered its rivers of empire through whatever means necessary to reclaim the arid Southwest, to green it up, as historian Patricia Nelson Limerick quips. In spite of Dene's claims to the Colorado River, Interior assured Peabody access to Arizona's, quote, unused portion to the waterway. On December 11, 1968, the Navajo Tribal Council passed Resolution CD-10868, essentially waiving Navajo rights to Colorado River water in exchange for, quote, limited promises by a consortium of utilities to light up the reservation's hogans. The council agreed to limit Dene demands on 50,000 acre-feet of water allocated to Arizona each year under the Upper Colorado River Basin Compact of 1948. Instead, council members granted 34,100 acre-feet of the tribe's annual apportionment to the Page Power Plant in order to water its cooling towers. The tribal council mandate ostensibly negated Dene claims to the Colorado River in favor of a coal-fired power plant that promised economic security and jobs for the Navajo Nation, as well as electricity. Interestingly, fragmentary evidence suggests Secretary Udall never approved CD-10868. His failure to endorse the agreement renders it virtually ineffective and does not legally bind the tribe, freeing the Dene to claim more than 50,000 acre-feet of water for tribal lands situated in Arizona's upper basin. Today, individual members of the Navajo Nation argue that the Colorado River belongs to the Dene and holds tremendous economic potential for the tribe if their government leaders, often influenced by white lawyers, would only assert the people's rights. By May 1969, the Tribal Council had entered negotiations with a conglomerate of utility companies to lease almost 2,000 acres of reservation land for the Navajo Generating Station. According to the Navajo Times, the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority would share in the plant's electrical output. Bureau of Indian Affairs Regional Director Graham Holmes told reporters the proposal fits in with overall plans to develop the reservation. Holmes's admission highlighted the efforts of both the Department of the Interior and the Navajo Tribal Council to industrialize the reservation during the post-war era. In this case, their actions displayed utter disregard for the people living in the shadows of Peabody's draglines, those traditional Navajos and Hopis whose families had inhabited the escarpment for generations. The Salt River Project, responsible for the operation and maintenance of the power plant, built the Navajo Generating Station in three phases. It completed the third and final unit in 1976. With smokestacks 7 stories high, the smoke billowing monster devours 23,000 tons of coal daily and swallows 270,000 gallons of Navajo water pumped out of Lake Powell per minute. The plant delivers 2,310 megawatts of electricity to its customers via 800 miles of transmission lines, marching across the desert like stormtroopers from Star Wars. Interior Secretary Udall worried Congress would never approve cap legislation authorizing hydroelectric dams in Grand Canyon, worked closely with Peabody and the region's utility companies to develop alternate solutions, eventually concocting the NGS to fuel the Central Arizona project. Reclamation, one of Interior's subordinate agencies, currently owns 24.3% of the electricity effusing from the Page Power Plant, while the Salt River Project claims 21.7%, Nevada Power receives 11.3%, the Arizona Public Service gets 14%, Tucson Gas and Electric maintains 7.5%, and finally, Los Angeles Water and Power holds 21.2%. The last figure evidently reflects the longtime controversy between Arizona and California over which states receives the most benefits from the Colorado River. We broke the mold with that plant, Secretary Udall reminisced years later.
Thank you so much, Sonia. One of the things that I'd like to bring up is that the complexity that went into the design of the Central Arizona Project, if we could apply that same level of complexity to looking at the bigger picture, the same energy that went into the Central Arizona Project and to creating a positive way of looking at what we're doing in the American Southwest, we'd be getting somewhere. I had really wanted a nice way to end this series of things that we're doing. So I invited two wonderful friends of mine to come and perform a song. The song is called La Indita del Rio Grande, which to me is one of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard in my life. So, without further ado, I would like to introduce my two great friends, Chuy Martinez and Oti Ruiz.
Pájaros, truenos y rayos, alas de papel dorado, panadero. 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 Nuevo México, mi tierra. País es mi país. Nuevo México, mi tierra, mi raíz es mi país. Es mi orgullo haber crecido entre frijol, chile y maíz. Panadero. Panadero. Tierra madre del encanto, embarazada por el sol. Tierra madre del encanto, embarazada por el sol. Vida, luz, tierra y colores, aguas de arroyo, cristal, Panajeón. Río grande, generoso, por tus venas aguada. Río grande, generoso, por tus venas aguada. Alimentas a tu gente con tanto vegetal, Panajeón. Panajeón. Panaje, panaje, panajeón. Panaje, panaje, panajeón. En tus montes se oyen voces silenciosas del pasado. En tus montes se oyen voces silenciosas del pasado. Son los cantos de los indios que alegre su vida dan. Panajeón. Panajeón. Es el cielo de tus tardes, el espejo del Creador. Es el cielo de tus tardes, el espejo del Creador. La sierra, sangre de Cristo,
La Indita de Rio Grande. And that followed Jack Leffler, John Fleck, Mike Hammond, and Dr. Sonia Dickey in the fifth and last of a series of panel discussions on water culture and climate change in the West, Thinking Like a Watershed, recorded at the Chemo Theater in Albuquerque. The panels are funded and sponsored by the New Mexico Humanities Council and The Lore of the Land. They're produced and moderated by oral historian, author, and producer Jack Leffler. If you have any comments on the series, we'd love to hear them, so please write to radiocafe@ksfr.org. You can also hear the whole series and the various question and answer sessions on the web at santafe.radiocafe.org. Before we go, I want to express my heartfelt gratitude and appreciation for Jack Leffler. He's been producing radio for decades and keeping alive a sense of the land, of habitat and wildlife and people who exist and live in their own right, not just as cogs in an economic machine, but as free and vibrant and sacred life. May his vision sink deeply into all of us, and may his infectious laugh remind us to have fun along the way. Thank you, Jack.